All right, so welcome to the Create Invent podcast, where we discuss all things creative and inventive. Today we've got a former guest, Brian Greiner. He's a science fiction author, former engineer, an author currently, and also, you know, a big science fiction fan. And kind of the way this podcast came about, I saw a documentary on Venus, and it was going over the first Venus flyby in 1962, I believe, with Mariner 2. And I realized that before that, people saw Venus as a potentially like a really jungle world, potentially, where, you know, all kinds of exotic things could exist. And I thought, man, if I liked science fiction in 1961, I would be totally disappointed just thinking this is not even a possibility now, because it's an uninhabitable planet, you know. And then, you know, years later, there's the Mars mission, and it just, I feel like everything changed. You know, in my mind, it was maybe ruined, but maybe it was just changed. So Brian, what do you think as an avid science fiction fan and a connoisseur, what are your opinions on this?
I think you summarize it well. Is it change? That's what science does. Now, my perspective is kind of different from young folks, is like you and Pat.
It's from my point of view. Nobody ever calls me young, Brian. Yes. I'm excited.
Well, I am 71 years old, so I was born in the early 50s. You got to remember that back then, things were wildly different. Like, there was no internet. Zero, zilch, none. It's the start of the Cold War. It was getting serious. Threats of nuclear death were a daily thing. Information was all in print, except for the mass media, radio and TV. And even TV was kind of new. You talk about the knowledge of Venus and Mars as being not very nice places, as being something that only came in the early 60s, as with the flybys. Well, that's not entirely true. People could make remote observations. The 1930s and 40s and 50s, they would do infrared surveys as best they could. In the 50s, they started doing microwave probes, and they knew that Venus was not a nice place. They didn't know how bad. These were all scientific papers, by and large. It never hit the mass media. So that most people, including science fiction writers, didn't know about this stuff unless they happened to know a planetary scientist.
Right. Because Pat was telling me about Larry Niven in his book, what is it, The Coldest Place, I guess, which is supposed to be on
Venus. I was going to say Jeremy, you have to not let me say just anymore. I got to stop saying, it's a short story.
What are you supposed to not say anymore, Pat?
The Coldest Place. Just.
Oh.
Like, I was going to say, it's just a short story, Jeremy. That's all it is. That's not a nice thing to say. I didn't mean to anything by that, but don't say that.
Short stories are the hardest thing to write.
I'll bet you.
But it was interesting.
They got to have a beginning, a middle, and an end in 300 words.
Well, but it was interesting because basically, like your premise, Pat, was that basically he wrote this short story, and then, like, I don't know, a couple weeks, months later, or whatever, it was like, well, Venus is totally, nobody's going to hang out on Venus because that's...
Well, it's it was not. Mercury, though, Jeremy.
Oh, it was Mercury?
The Coldest Place was about, we thought Mercury was tidally locked with the sun, so it had a hot, like the moon is locked to us, it had a hot side and a cold side.
All right.
And his story was about I don't even remember, something going on the cold, like, it was, for us it would be habitable in some way, like we could build a space station on the cold side, and... You know, some number of weeks later, our probe made it to Mercury. They said, nope, it's not tidally locked. We could see it. Look at it go. Mm-hmm. It's spinning.
Well, maybe my facts are off a little bit here.
But you're
close
enough. You got the right idea.
Yeah.
All right.
I don't think it changes much. A lot of short stories, especially the short ones, are about a gimmick, a twist. It's a way of having a bit of fun. Although sometimes the fun can have an awful sharp edge to it. But it's basically about people dealing with extreme situations. The extreme situation might change a bit. So the snap, the twist, is kind of ruined because it's not real, if you will. You know, that's the case for those short stories. Planetary information changes. If the public knew what the public was told through the mass media, by and large, or there were books. And if you were lucky to hear about a book somehow, then information would get diffused that way. But a lot of these scientific studies that I mentioned earlier were just published in scientific journals. So a lot of science fiction authors wouldn't see it. So the stuff that got into the public mind, memes you'd call them now, kids with your fancy words, that stuck for years and decades. Like back in the 30s, Nobel Prize winning scientist said, based on his calculations, Venus should be a hot, wet planet. That stuck, and that really didn't get disproved in the public mind. It's the so-called canals on Mars, for example. You know, that was back in 1870s, an Italian gentleman, I should mention his name, Giovanni Schiaparelli. Now, I've probably offended every Italian listening, but I'm trying not to. He saw channels, but the English language press, as they often do, liked the word canals. And so that caught the public imagination. Percival Lowell, an amateur astronomer who was quite wealthy, so he could indulge himself, thought this was wonderful. And he created fabulous maps of canals and was convinced these were all artificially created. And he wrote a lot of popular books, and that caught the public imagination. So even though in the 50s, even before the space probes, scientists were saying, no, these are not nice places. The atmosphere on Venus is mostly CO2. The atmosphere on Mars is mostly CO2. Venus might be as hot as the boiling point of water. Mars is like the Antarctic. And people are going, no. And then NASA had enough PR oomph in those days that people really listened when NASA spoke, and it caught the public imagination. The NASA probes shattered the myth, and that's what it took in those days, because you didn't have the internet, as I said.
This stuff was known. It just wasn't maybe known in the mass, to the masses, I guess. Is that, exactly. I guess that's the point. So
the masses, including writers, by and large.
Well, you know, I mean, the interesting thing is, I read that story, the Coldest Place, and even though a lot of the science was dated, even like I'm not in that world exactly, I could tell a lot of it was dated. It was still an interesting story. And as you say, mm-hmm. you know, you're solving a challenge, and it's, you know, I think you have the hard versus soft science fiction crowd or whatever, and maybe it wouldn't hold up to so-called hard, you know, this is all based on truth now. But as far as just an interesting story, you know, you could almost call it fantasy in a way, but you know, in space. And it was, I thought it was a fun story. And honestly, I was that was my first experience with Larry Niven, you know, as a writer. And I was like, I'd like to read some more by him. So even if it doesn't maybe hold up today, like say The Expanse or something like that.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Larry Niven, he wrote a very famous book called Ringworld, where he posited a giant ring around a sun, like sort of like the Earth's orbit, but one giant ring. You know, he wasn't the first to think of this, but he really thought about it, and he thought about making it into a good, rousing story. And then 10 years later, he was forced to write a sequel because a lot of people took this stuff seriously, as you said, Jeremy, that, you know, as the hard science people. And they said, no, it's not stable. It wouldn't work. So he came up with a second story called Ringworld Engineers.
Oh, okay.
That was published 10 years later. And Ringworld was first published in 1970. And Ringworld Engineers went into and addressed a number of those technical issues. But then he built those into the story to build drama. So, you know, a good writer, and Larry Niven, amazing writer, was able to use those flaws to his advantage. He was a classically trained science fiction writer, if you will, where the snap stories, the writers played with ideas.
What do you mean by classically trained science fiction writer? And
well,
for that matter, where would you go to get trained on?
It's not trained, but grew up in the era where you had science fiction was to play with ideas. The characters were secondary, but you showed your chops by having the snap, the twist, and it had to be clever. Science fiction would have these phases where people, writers as a group, would play with ideas, and it was almost like they were challenging each other to see who could come up with the niftiest twist. Like there was the locked room type of stories. Now that's popular is the murder mysteries, but science fiction took that because they had locked room mysteries in space or on the different planets, or the effect living in space would have on somebody's view of what's normal. Like there was a famous one by, for example, Isaac Asimov, and where the murderer who had been born and raised in space had hid some evidence outside on the balcony because the way he was raised, that was a good place.
Right.
That yeah, no one ever went.
Outside.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas on Earth, yes.
That's not. You open the window and place.
There you can breathe. It was a fabulous twist, but it made a lot of sense from the people point of view and the social point of view. And then they got into deals with the devil. That was big for a while. Like, how do you beat the devil? And people would come up with fabulous ideas. One of the best was published in Analog magazine some years ago. It's a series of rejection letters where he's submitting stories and the editor's saying, no, we don't publish stories about deals with the devil. He goes to hell and he gets a rejection letter from Satan saying, I'm sorry, we don't publish stories about deals with the editor.
And this is a science fiction book, a short story.
Yeah. I mean, it was Analog is a science fiction magazine, but they'll have always been willing to stretch the definition of science fiction.
You know,
so long as there's fun in it.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah.
Well, now,
but then there Brian, are you, stories.
You are a self-published author, as we talked about in our last podcast. But you know, you talk about rejection letters. Did you ever try to get a book published with a, you know, large publisher or anything? Have you have any experience with that?
No, I did write a short story decades ago, and I submitted it, and they said, "Thank you for your submission. Unfortunately, at this time." Now it was a form letter. But it was a thrill to get something from a major magazine at the time.
Yeah.
But it was a stupid story, but still. This was in the day where you had to mail something to them, like a physical story typed out on paper. You would always give them a return postage so that they could mail it back. And it came back and it had obviously been scuffed. Now, whether they just felt sorry for me and threw it on the floor and scuffed it with their shoe a bit just to give the illusion, but
yeah, that's what interns did back then. Like, all right, we got these over here. You got your make sure you
scuffer.
Got your muddy boots on
this. Yeah, you know, I think this poor person seemed like they, you know, as like somebody human has actually read it. But the publishing industry has changed quite a bit since those early days, and as well as the volume of people submitting. So these days, it's not worthwhile.
So are there more people? More people submitting these days to publications?
There's more people and there's fewer markets. Like decades ago, was when I was growing up in my 20s and 30s, your age.
Well, thank you.
There were magazines, lots of magazines. And the advice for writers there was just keep submitting it to the different magazines and somebody will buy it. Because I say there was no internet. There was no cable TV, so people read. And the book market was, again, different. You could submit as an author. These days, publishers don't want to hear from authors. They want to hear from agents. So these days, what you have to do is first get an agent.
There's a whole new layer in there.
There's a whole new layer. And that's not necessarily a wrong thing. But it's another filter. And if you got to find the right, back in the olden days, publishers would work with authors to train them, to groom them. They would take, and they would take more chances. And they would expect that most of them would not make them any money, but they didn't know which one. So they would work with them and try to improve people. These days, it's you must sell a gazillion copies or you're not worth their time. It's a little better than that, but not much, because it's run by MBAs, not by people that love books.
That's interesting. So you, it seems to me, even though you haven't, maybe you're not in that world exactly, it seems like you have some insight into this. I think you're a member of some writing groups, and I think your wife's a writer too in some capacity, I believe. So maybe that's where your insight comes from.
Not only that, but I do research. I mean, that's my training and inclination.
Oh, yeah, right.
And of course, it's very easy to do research these days. And the old masters, their writing advice is by and large worthless nowadays. The only advice that really matters from the old masters from their era is sit down, put your butt in the chair and write. The only way that you improve. It's much the same with any engineering or, learning to play a musical instrument. Practice makes perfect, or if not perfect, at least better.
That's true. I will say, going back to the, like you said, the old masters and such like that, right, reading, again, I haven't read a lot of Larry Niven. I just kind of got into it with that, because that book, that story that Pat recommended was a series of short stories was the book I found for it. And I'm like, oh, these are really neat. And I started getting into it. And, I realized that a lot of the concepts that he talks about, like people, even I think Belter, people like outer space, people like Belters, even Autodoc, I think a lot of things he mentions, I feel like it inspired later sci-fi, especially The Expanse. I mean, just some of the concepts there as far as the Belters being like a separate people. Also, I just want to say this. There's the Kiven or something, the cat race or something, that they're very warlike.
They're in Star Trek, Jeremy.
The Kazin.
The Kazin? Yeah. Oh, they are literally...
They are actual Star Trek aliens now.
Okay. Because I was thinking...
From the Larry Niven wrote some... animated series episodes.
Oh, okay. All right. So that's,
and they
that's
were like, all over the animated series.
So that's legitimate. That's okay. But I was thinking, Wing Commander, the Kilrathi, the cat aliens. I mean, it starts with a K too. It seems
for
like,
sure.
It's hard to get around.
Everybody
that
steals.
One. Yeah.
It's an interesting science fiction story last year. And it was written in 1960, and it had aliens called the Horta. Now, if you're a science fiction or if you're a Star Trek fan of the original series, the Horta were one of the alien species. And they had another one that I can't recall the name of off the top of my head, unfortunately, but it was also used in Star Trek, the original series. And I looked at the date pretty carefully going, who stole this? But it predates Star Trek. So Roddenberry or whoever wrote those episodes obviously borrowed. I'm just always curious as they borrowed with permission.
Yeah. One or two of the original series writers was a science fiction author, a famous science fiction author. And I'm completely drawing a blank. I didn't think to write this down for when I studied for this test. But
sorry,
it's not impossible that the book that you're referring to was written by the same, writer. Possible. I'm not saying it is, but.
Because don't forget, a lot of writers used pen names so that they could write something for that company and something for that company and no one would associate them.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Well, I mean, even today,
in terms of Larry Niven, and the Belters, as you say, that predates him by at least a generation.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's a concept that just kind of, it makes sense. It's just something that wouldn't I don't know. It's not like, say, cat aliens that start with a K. That's pretty, it's a little specific, yeah. But, you know, the Belters and the Autodoc and stuff, I feel like that's, you know, it's a general concept that maybe Larry Niven would have hit on anyway. It's something that, you know, you hear and you could see it, you know, you could see it, you know, if there was two worlds of science fiction that never intersected, you could see the same thing maybe happening, if that makes
any Jeremy, sense. Jeremy, I think something that you're noticing is that, yeah, I've noticed, I've read a lot of science fiction. I don't know how much is a lot, but I feel like it's been a lot. And I feel like somewhere around when Larry Niven was writing, things became a lot more modern feeling than, you know, 20 years earlier when Asimov was, like, I don't enjoy reading Asimov very much. It feels off. It feels dated. It feels.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Right.
But Larry Niven stuff feels, they can make movies out of Larry Niven stuff and it would be, you wouldn't have to change much and it'd be fine.
Yeah, I would, again, I haven't read that much. I haven't really read that much of either one, but I agree. It seems like the little I've read of Asimov, it's like, you know, good for him for, you know, writing so much. But, you know, it feels a little dated. I agree.
They're doing a fantastic job turning Asimov's work into the Foundation TV show on Apple TV. That's fantastic.
Is it? I've
very good.
Mixed reviews of it. Literally, you say it's very good. Somebody else said it wasn't so good. So,
I'm enjoying it, and I read at least one Foundation novel, and I hated the novel. I did not enjoy my time reading it.
Okay, but I think that was that guy's difference, because I think he liked the novel, and apparently didn't like the TV show. So that's because I understand it was quite different.
I bet I sure hope so because okay. The original work would have been, it would have felt weird on TV today, I would imagine.
Yeah, a lot of that older stuff, they can't show today because it doesn't make sense. It's from a sociological point of view, and Asimov's writing was too terse for television. It was not visual. So you'd have to translate it. And he was more about concepts than people. Very much so. And
can you give an example of something that maybe wouldn't make sense today? I mean, from a, you know.
Well, I could, around Foundation, a lot of it's based on psychology. And the psychology understanding we had in the 1950s is very different than what we have today. Without knowing without me remembering any of the specifics of the book.
Okay.
I mean, all of that felt a little.
It was actually deeper than that, Pat. It was not just the psychology, but it was called psychohistory. They would use the principles of psychology and history to be able to predict the future with a high degree of accuracy.
And that's the thread that runs through the TV show. That's still in there, but it's very hand wavy and
right. You know, they don't the talk... books. It was a major plot point.
Yeah, okay. And explained a lot in the book. You know, they talk about how it actually works or how it should work in the book.
Okay. I wouldn't want to know about that because that's just kind of nonsense at this point. So, you know.
Well, it's nonsense, but it got a lot of people talking about it and thinking about the concept of it and realizing, it wouldn't work. It's an interesting idea and people keep trying it. But certain aspects do work. Advertising. You know, people spend huge money on these advertising things and they test, and that is applied psychology. So it's psychohistory, but on a very narrow focus. And even then they get it wrong. So the idea that you could predict centuries worth of human history is silly. But it's an interesting thing to think about because it gets you thinking about psychology. It gets you thinking about historical trends. People used to say that history repeats. Well, people looked past that very generic, hand-wavy statement and go, well, it may not repeat per se, but it does sort of get within waving distance of past cycles. And I mean, for
I would
while,
I agree with that to some extent.
There are people that wrote books about the cycles of history, and that got into some SF, especially by a writer named Van Vogt. Big in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And he would take an idea and just build a story on it. Very nerdy, very, very formalized. But it was fun to play with the ideas. And it got people thinking and talking. And it isn't so much whether the idea per se is absolutely correct, but the fact it gets people thinking about things. And that's really the high point, or the most important thing about science fiction to me, is it gets people thinking. And that's what got a lot of people into doing engineering.
Because I think that's why I became an engineer to some extent. Maybe not the science fiction that I read per se, but I remember reading Popular Science as a kid, and yeah, some science fiction, and just thinking like, oh, those robots in Star Wars are so cool, I have to do something like that. And what's kind of cool is I remember, growing up, I'm like, oh, it'd be so cool to write for Popular Science, and I've done that. So that's, that was a nice success to do before they became not a magazine anymore, which is a little sad to know. But the world turns, I guess, as we kind of alluded to.
Yeah.
Speaking of that, do you guys want to take a little coffee break, and when we come back, we'll do some more interesting discussion.
That sounds good to me, Jeremy.
All right. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. All right, Peck. Well, welcome to the coffee break, where we give a shout out to our top five or so patrons. Shall I go ahead and just read that out?
I think you should, Jeremy, because you have the list.
Okay.
Jeremy doesn't let me into the money.
I got the list.
He doesn't trust me with that.
Well, Pat's never really asked for it. Timothy Moran, thank you so much. Carl, thank you. Michael Sizer, Raptor, creatively spelled. Stuart Morrow, Brian Moses, and Positive_Waves. Thank you so much for your sponsorship, and we really, really appreciate it. Now, Pat, I mean,
we do.
People don't have to support us monetarily. We love that. We appreciate it. But if they want to do something else nice for us, what would they do?
Well, they could like or subscribe and hit thumbs ups and leave comments. And that makes, this podcast shows up in audio and video in all sorts of places. And most of those places have algorithms of some sort. So they like when you click things and touch things and leave comments. And that helps us out.
Right.
A lot.
Absolutely. Or
Jeremy, if somebody really did want to send us a dollar or two a month to help us, because, this riverside.fm that I'm looking at costs us money.
Yeah.
And there's other things that cost money.
Yeah. Well, that's right. If somebody did want to support us,
the deepest of pockets.
It'd be patreon.com/createinvent. So patreon.com/createinvent is where you can sponsor us with actual money if you like. Maybe we'll have a link to or something in the description or comments or whatever else. So that'd be awesome. Other thing.
It would be awesome if we had a link.
That would be awesome. Other link, you can go to speakpipe.com/createinvent, and you can leave us an actual message. And we can play it on the air if you like, or if you don't.
Actual message, he means a voice audio message.
Voice.
So you can talk to us and we can play it on the air. And we've been doing a bad job of telling people to go there. So,
but yeah, you should go to there. And, we'll assume if you leave us a message, you're okay with it being played on the air. If you leave us a name, same thing. But if you want it to be anonymous or just want to say, hey, you guys need to do this better, don't play it on the air. Just let us know that and we can accommodate. So, yeah.
We can.
Yeah. So with all that, Pat, why don't we get people back to your regularly scheduled show or whatever they used to say.
Let's do it.
Da-da-da-da-da-da.